Hi everyone, and welcome to an update on our fund. My name is Michael Frazis, and today I'll give a brief rundown of financial year of 2021, which closed 30th of June. I'll talk about the regulatory crackdown in China, the huge sell-off that resulted, and how we played that. And I'll also give a few comments on Square's recent acquisition of Afterpay. So this is us. We invest in technology and the life sciences. We typically invest in quite large companies. The median market cap's over $10 billion, and actually the median growth rate's about 150%. So our companies are growing organically at 150%. So these are large listed companies growing extremely fast, adding users extremely fast, and are materially bigger, better, and stronger every week. And basically what we do is we invest in companies with two characteristics. It's true customer love and explosive growth. And the reason we do that is that gets us in the right companies early. It allows us to invest early when companies in that phase of heavy investment, but are adding huge amounts of value by really growing the size of their business. We find these two things give you the right answer to those questions. And about a third of the companies in life sciences, which has its own kind of calculations. We've got plenty of videos and recordings of our strategy, so we'll just move straight on to the update. To me, there are three key moments. The first was right at the beginning. Three key moments of financial year 2021. The first was on 1st of July. So there was a huge sell-off in March 2020, which we'll all remember vividly. And then there was a strong rally for a few months. And a lot of people thought that was irrational. There was comments saying, this is crazy. You know, markets don't know what they're doing. By 1st of July, that had been going on for a couple of months, or more than a couple of months. And the reality was, that was the beginning and not the end. Now, we didn't have a crystal ball. We didn't know what was going to happen next. But we did know that, you know, over the long term, over a multi-decade career in investing, you cannot sell every time markets move up 20 or 30%. You know, you have to stay invested in the rallies as well as all the sell-offs. Like, that is the optimal strategy if you're optimizing for returns over a long period of time. And as it turned out, that was the beginning and not the end. You know, things rallied continuously from then all the way up until February, which was kind of, I guess, the second phase. So a lot of people that bought their first stocks in that sell-off of 2020. You know, we now know the data. You can look at there's charts that show that institutions were net sellers, which certainly fits with my experience. And if you read about, you know, the updates from Magellan and so on, the big funds in Australia and offshore, institutions were selling. And I think it was also committee-driven. You know, if you sit down in a risk committee, you're not panicking. No one's pulling their hair out, jumping out of windows. You're just thinking, you know, it's the coronavirus is here. We don't know what's going to happen next. We should tone down risk. It's so sensible. Almost all investment firms are set up to operate like that. You know, that's how they get their money. That's how they sign off. That's how they get institutional capital. That's how they get support from all the various gatekeepers. The problem is that kind of process-driven or management by committee kind of process to investing means you're generally selling at the wrong times, generally buying at the wrong times too. And that's precisely what we saw. So if the institutions were selling, who were buying? You know, it was the retail investors. And they just had a charmed run. Everything basically worked all the way up until February. This also coincided with kind of a SPAC boom where people were listing companies literally on presentations. And people talk about getting crazy valuations on presentations, on PowerPoints. This is the first time I've actually seen that as bad as it was. You know, companies with no revenue forecasting $1 billion of revenue plus, sometimes even a lot more in several years' time. 6 months later, many of them are already writing down their promises and things have been smashed. But all the way up until February, growth had like a huge rip up and we're beneficiaries of that. We did some things right. I mean, for example, we bought a company, Plug Power, for a few dollars, went all the way up to 68, 72. We sold a lot of our stock around then. We did sell a few things that went up 10, 15, 20 times. They're generally pretty small positions that became large and we exited or reduced, but we did buy other growth stocks. So then what happened was when the market turned, we're fully invested, which is broadly how you can expect us to be at all times. Anyway, and that sell-off basically continued until May and really steepened into a kind of capitulation in the middle of May. And that's when we did some pretty good work though, because that's when, with the benefit of hindsight and seeing where prices traded after, we got an insight into all the companies. There was a reporting season around then, and there are a few that growth had slowed down or they had began to spend far too much to achieve their growth. And we exited those, were able to add to some of our better positions pretty close to the lows, and that kind of helped us in June, where we had a very strong month and got to finish the year on a high. So that was kind of 2021. Moderna was one of our key contributors. So this is a company that I guess we bought in the low 20s and is now actually of around $400. This chart's about a week old. And this company has, you know, orders of 40 billion. It's 150 billion now, but when we were buying, it was obviously a fraction of that. And it's striking. I remember when Moderna listed, everyone in biotech was saying, this is the most outrageous valuation we've ever come across. This is the most overvalued stock ever to hit the markets. It didn't have a product. And it's so interesting to see the end of that journey or see where we are a few years later, because it's become the best performing stock. And so often that happens. So often there's an extremely high quality business that's doing something on a different level to everybody else. The valuation looks crazy, but you look back a few years later and go, wow, they really executed. That was special. That did warrant a 20, 30, 40, 50% higher price, because it then went on to do 20 times. You know, and that's this is another example of which there are many, and which if we try and specialize in, we see that to be the case. One we kind of missed was actually BioNTech, which is a bit disappointing, because we probably should have done that. Whoops, there's a there's a calendar invite there. So BioNTech was trading at about $78 billion with kind of $12 billion of forecast sales. So you can see that even after huge moves up, those companies are very much undervalued on a traditional metric basis. So they've switched to the point where if you screen on cash flow, you know, those companies will look better than anything in the world right now. I guess another interesting facet of those two companies is they both have extensive pipelines. Moderna's is much better, but they do have pipelines and they'll use those cash flows to kind of fund their entire development of the rest of their pipeline. You know, Pfizer and Moderna have gone to the EU and actually negotiated price increases. So you can see the importance of these companies now. They're going to an organization as large and powerful as the EU and getting price increases. And the reason for that's pretty simple. I mean, it's just a case of value. You know, countries like Australia will spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars every single week to support people who are temporarily out of work due to the crisis. But even at 20-something euros a vaccine, maybe 40, 50 euros for two doses, that is exceptionally good value for what it actually offers. And that remains the case. And another thing that's kind of happened more recently is people are very much voting with their feet on these vaccines. There's several of them out in the market, several are approved, and people want the good ones, and people want the ones that have been in the market the longest, that have the most extensive data, and have been proven to work, you know, 90 to 95%, to be 90 to 95% effective. There are some new ones coming up that are quite interesting. There's one that uses an inactivated version of the virus. So Moderna and Pfizer, BioNTech, basically the whole thing works by getting your body to recognize the spike protein, so the surface, and that's the bit that can mutate and potentially make it hard or potentially reduce the efficacy of these vaccines. If you have an inactivated version of the entire virus, your body chews it up and then starts to recognize all the different parts. So it's probably going to work for every variant. But, you know, they're at a huge disadvantage in the sense that, you know, a billion doses of these mRNA vaccines have already been given. So we have excellent data. We know they work. They've kind of lodged themselves in their mind that Pfizer is the good one, Moderna is the good one. They'll be very hard to dislodge. And it's looking increasingly likely like there will be booster shots after booster shots. There's still enormous political willpower, enormous popular like desire to be vaccinated. Another interesting company was Carvana. I mean, we bought this in the low 40s, and I guess now it's over 340. So not quite 10x, but getting there. The curious thing about Carvana was in the year, secondhand cars became worth more than, were selling for more than they were actually paid for new. So they're appreciating assets. Now, we actually think that will probably reverse at some point. It kind of has to. You know, cars are not houses. They do get materially worse with time. The reason that kind of happened was a few things. You know, supply chains were stretched. There was a chip shortage. But really, the first half of 2020 was a really bad year for automakers. You know, they saw 30, 40, 50% declines at one point, and obviously adjusted their production schedules accordingly. And then the boom that happened afterwards took them by surprise. Actually took everyone by surprise. So the way we think about it is there was a huge shock in March 2020. It triggered a huge range of new behaviors in lockdown. There were a few companies, technology companies, e-commerce companies, that were massive beneficiaries of all that screen time, all that time people were spending, all that extra money people had because they weren't traveling or eating out. And most people did keep their jobs or even do better. But that kind of morphed into more of a consumer boom, and it started affecting other things like real estate, autos, actually anything to do with consumer. And that was kind of the story of kind of, say, I guess, late 2020 till today. And Carvana was a beneficiary of that. Let's move on to the Chinese sell-off. So this kind of began with Jack Ma, who ran Alibaba or runs Alibaba. He gave a speech about the regulators right before he was about to IPO Ant Financial. And then the Chinese regulators made him pull the IPO. That caused a bit of a shock because it took everybody by surprise and reminded everybody that in China, you know, political power rules supreme in a way that there's not the same kind of checks and balances and transparencies elsewhere. Another element of this recently was there was a crackdown on Didi, which is Chinese Uber, shortly after IPO. And there's all kinds of new regulation coming out. Tencent and Alibaba are going to have to open up their walled gardens. They're going to have to compete. And there's a broad attack on tech monopolies. At the same time, there's increasing government support for electric vehicles, for high-tech manufacturing, all kinds of things. But this was a shock. So the Chinese biggest internet companies, for people listening on the podcast, you can't see this chart, but you can see a huge rip from, you know, 2 trillion market cap to 2.6 trillion in February, which is kind of that big growth rush into anything technology and growth that I talked about earlier. And then they dropped about 25% over the following 5 months. And then the last couple of weeks dropped another, I guess, 20%. And that was a real capitulation. You can see there's a huge panic. And much of that was actually triggered by moves on tutoring. So the Chinese announced that henceforth, for-profit tutoring companies would now be not-for-profit. It was a bit of a shock to the sector. So this was actually one of the hottest parts of the global venture capital market. In fact, last year, over $10 billion was put into these companies for education technology startups in China, which is a huge amount of money. And the combined value of these was over $100 billion. And that is effectively worth next to nothing now. They're allowed to tutor, but it has to be adult tutoring and it has to be, you know, piano lessons, things like that, not kind of the end of school examinations that were so profitable. And you can see that took most investors by surprise. The next day, most of these companies lost 60, 70, 80%. And really, you know, it's one of those moments where if you get caught in one of these, you actually sell it. Like, these are sells after that, not buys. It's kind of interesting now because you can go back and see that the Chinese flag every single one of these moves. So this is a speech from President Xi Jinping. He's giving a speech about for-profit tutoring companies. An industry calling for conscience should not become profit-driven. We should regulate these training organizations pursuant to the law and make them focus on well-rounded development of students. So he basically told everybody he wants them to be non-profits. And well-rounded, that's referring to those piano lessons and such, extracurriculars. Now everybody's going through all of his past speeches and trying to figure out where they're going next. But another really useful source of information about what they're doing, what they're thinking, is actually the editorials of state media. So they'll often editorialize and give precise reasons for what they're doing. So a recent editorial said a few things. I'll just quote from it now. So a few behemoths could easily capitalize their wide-ranging network of resource and access to funding to expand into more spheres. Startups could easily be strangled halfway through their entrepreneurial stages, which is almost certainly true. The capital market is obsessed with monopoly-induced premiums. Platforms with larger market shares tend to get higher valuations. They then finished the article with, that would suggest the current capital-centric approach to churning out internet titans will have to be redesigned, with existing valuation models refashioned accordingly. And indeed, as we saw in the sell-off, existing valuation models were refashioned accordingly. But there's a few, the broad idea here is actually kind of sensible. I mean, Alibaba and Tencent both form their own separate ecosystems. Their main apps do not speak to each other. They don't go on each other's platforms. Startups in China generally have to pick one, and then they're locked into that ecosystem. They're basically saying those two companies will have to open up to each other and also to all new startups. So they won't be able to have these closed gardens. Alibaba also used to insist on exclusivity when they were from their manufacturers. They will no longer be able to do that. All these kinds of moves are kind of moves against these kind of big internet monopolies that effectively reach user saturation and then make money by basically milking that existing user base. That's one thing we try and avoid when we invest in growth companies. We want companies that are growing users as well as revenues. So there's a lot of companies like, say, Spotify that reach relative user saturation, and now the game is to milk more and more out of them. Chinese regulators are kind of saying they don't want that. And in fact, Didi was probably the worst, a classic case example of why that's so bad. So they've got over 90% market share. They're losing money. They competed fiercely, lost money for many, many years. They're backed by SoftBank, who sunk, I think it was $10 billion or something on that order of magnitude into the company. And now, obviously, they want to raise prices and milk the monopoly that they've been able to create. They also have discriminatory age practices where they charge more to older people. And I think even Uber hasn't stooped that low in the West. So very sympathetic to all these moves. Like, they really seem to be for the right reasons. There's obviously a side effect in the sense that the leaders of these big tech companies were amassing huge amounts of power, political power, and they were starting to push against those boundaries. So there is an element of obviously kind of removing that. But the reality is, like, these are good moves. They're consumer-friendly moves. And actually, if you think about who the winners are, it's consumers, it's a startup ecosystem. I think the ruthlessness of the moves, you know, just declaring a whole industry not profit will scare people. There will be a material, you know, discount. You think about Tencent and Alibaba, they'll be valued materially lower now. They had a cozy duopoly and were able to get bumper profits. Competing directly is good for consumers, but it's going to decrease the overall profit pool. So it is rational for these prices to come down and obviously, or valuations to come down, and obviously the stock prices and values will then grow with execution over the following years. I think this will probably put a bit of a chill on venture capital, potentially a freeze. I don't think the foreign investors will be so keen to back fast-growing sectors unless they're absolutely certain that that the political winds are in their favor, for example, in electric vehicles rather than education startups. But, you know, even the education startups, it just makes a lot of sense. I mean, imagine what it's like for a Beijing mother that has to spend the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars to educate their child on top of their school. You know, in many hands, like, the system had evolved to a point where that was required, but really education should probably be in the hands of the state. I'm not sure if the move will have the intended effect, because it's so important for these kids to be in the top 1% to 2% if they can. It's just going to be ultra competitive. The kids that will make it will be working extremely hard. But I can see why. You can see the logic behind the move. It's also tied in very much with the idea that Chinese have finally realized over the last few years that one child policy was not just cruel, but it was also bad for their development, you know, because they have a demographic issue like nobody else. There's a lot of countries with demographic issues. China's the worst by far because of that one child policy. And this is an attempt to kind of reverse that. They've now reversed the one child policy, but then people still aren't having kids. You know, it's extremely expensive and stressful to raise one. And having these foreign venture capital funded startups plastering the mums with advertisements, preying on these anxieties, you can see why the move was made. Pinduoduo is probably a loser, which is a shame because they were performing extremely well. You know, they just announced over 150% revenue growth. They're probably doing the most interesting thing in agriculture, as well as broader e-commerce, and they've started to expand that model overseas to South America. So they were going from strength to strength, and you can see in this chart, or if you're listening, I can describe it, there's just been huge upgrades throughout the year. But they were, one thing that was missed about the model was they basically used Tencent social graph. So I have a lot of sympathy with the moves the Chinese regulators are making. Also feel like, well, there's plenty of people in the West that think people should do similar things, kind of the massive tech conglomerates in the US. And one of the options is to open up Facebook social graph. So new startups are able to effectively launch on Facebook and use the existing network of users. Kind of how Instagram, you know, piggybacked off existing social graphs. That's what Pinduoduo did with Tencent. But now, and Alibaba has their own copycat, but now Alibaba's copycat will be able to compete on WeChat on Tencent's platform, which will be a problem for Pinduoduo. They'll have to be good because competition's going up for them. But, you know, from here, the valuation has come right down. So if you can get ahead of these moves, great, well done. But after these moves, generally the rational thing is actually to hold the line if the company's still executing, and that's what we're doing. And a company, most of our positions are 2 to 3%, and that's kind of the range that Pinduoduo is. And, you know, we bought this company in the 20s and bought some below 20. And even after these huge moves, it's over $90. So this shows you these high growth strategies. You know, we've made 4 times on this thing in a couple of years. Most people will be pretty happy with that return. And that is after a huge sell-off where the entire competitive landscape of Pinduoduo has changed for the worse, which really just shows you how good it can be to hold these companies that execute for more than 2 years. You know, in the short term, and we had a lot of investors join us over the last few months, been the last 6 months. In the short term, you can get hit by these 30, 40% corrections and they just happen like that. But if you're willing to hold these companies for 2, 3, 4 years, that's when you get those compounding growth, which really kind of reduces the risk relative to your entry price, as well as give the chance for outsized returns. So how did we react? So we basically increased our exposure by about 50% last week, Wednesday, to China. It's sitting at about 16, 17% total now. The reason we did this, and it was, I'd say it's pretty kind of consensus, when, you know, everybody's panicking, everyone's saying, you know, China is uninvestable, and these are the top investors in the world, you know, commenting on this in Twitter, saying these things. There's a few reasons. So we think the moves are reasonable. I tried to explain that we think that, you know, the regulators are making the right moves. These are consumer-friendly regulators. It's friendly for the ecosystem. It's good for competition. The companies have now repriced significantly, so they're much, much better value. Before, you know, these political risks were probably not priced in enough. Now they're kind of priced in such that, you know, there's an extreme risk that the Chinese might just delist all companies or something like that. But there's no indication that's the case. The other point along those lines is regulators completely changed their tone on Wednesday before we bought. Basically, they went from being kind of aggressive and saying they're going to crack down on these companies to being supportive. You know, they called in the top leaders of foreign investment firms in China and gave messages of support. When I was writing my article on the weekend, they released a statement saying, again, in one of the state media editorials, saying that, look, they support the right of companies to list anywhere, to dual list. That's a decision for companies. They're going to continue to open up their financial system. And, you know, the change in tone from that, from, you know, valuation models need to be refashioned. This sector will now be not-for-profit. To then talking about opening up your financial system and offering messages of support, it's clear the word came out. And there was a moment, what was it? Oh, yeah, somebody wrote an editorial on Tencent. It's funny in these countries, you need to be really quick on the about turn, because if the political winds change at the top, everybody needs to change accordingly. And some people are a bit slow to kind of about turn. And I think that happened in this editorial, because somebody came out and started criticizing gaming, not Tencent directly, making comments about kids should spend less time on games, which is another political issue in China. Tencent dropped 10% immediately, and the article was retracted from the internet. So my guess is the author didn't quite realize that, you know, things had changed, and he was supposed to be writing messages of support rather than continuing the attack, which no doubt was told to him less than a few days earlier. So now you've got a point where this huge sell-off was caused by this six-month regulatory crackdown. Much of that has happened. You know, Alibaba's now settled, and prices have reacted accordingly. And now regulators have changed to being supportive. So to us, that speaks of opportunity. We acted on that. The other interesting thing is there was interesting price actions. Firstly, things stabilized. Secondly, companies that were being supported by the Chinese, even ones that were listed in the US, performed pretty strongly. So Beijing's like a worth tens of billions of dollars. It's the leading Chinese biotech with some best-in-class oncology assets. They were basically resilient throughout. And then electric vehicles like Li and XPeng and so on actually went up throughout the period and were very, very resilient, even though they were kind of the source of a lot of speculative capital. So you'd think in one of these sell-offs that they would do worse, but actually they did better. And that's because, firstly, they're growing at 200, 300%, but secondly, they're being supported by the market. Policy is moving in that direction. And you can see in this chart how big the move was. This is a chart of KWEB, which is a Chinese internet ETF. At the beginning of the year, it went from, you know, 75 to 105, so 50% move in a few weeks. And then from 105 all the way back down to 70. And then in a couple of weeks in July, dropped from, I guess, 70 to 45, or high 40s. So huge move, huge, and that looks exactly like a capitulation to us. You know, a six-month sell-off that ends in a 20, 30% dip in a few short weeks, followed by a complete change in sentiment around whatever, sorry, a complete change in attitude around regulators or whatever the cause may be. Whatever the cause of the sell-off was, that has now reversed at the same time as things are capitulating. That to us is a good indication that you should be a buyer, not a seller. We've been asked about the Afterpay acquisition by Square. Look, it's a full valuation. Afterpay went as high as $160, and this deal was done at a valuation, you know, maybe 20-30% less than that. So it gives you kind of indication of Nick Mulder and Antti Ison's idea of where value lies in buy now, pay later. They basically invented the sector. They made it what it was. They know it better than anybody else. They have access to probably minute-by-minute data. So if they're selling out at a certain price, it gives you a good indication of where they think the market is. But really, it's not really sellout. I think sellout sounds too negative. You know, they're very much partnering with Square and you get a huge chunk of Square stock. You know, we've talked before about the holy grail in payments is to get a closed loop. You know, so if you can get merchants, customers buying things off merchants, off your app, off your platform, you don't have to go through, you can just match those transactions and cash flows. You don't have to go through the payment system, which is this whole Byzantine archaic thing. There's no metadata. You have to pay all these different people from Visa, MasterCard, and so on to switches. And it's just a horrible technology. It's slow. It's, to the extent that it's fast, it's very limited in the kind of data that can do. You can't attach receipts, things like that. And ultimately, a huge amount of margin goes there. It's why payments, even today, if you set up an online store, you can be paying 2, 3, 4%. Of transaction fees, which is crazy. Afterpay and Square both were very serious about getting the merchant side. So that was really the key to Afterpay. It was recognizing that early. So I remember 5 years ago when they came out, I was like, there's no way a low margin retailer is gonna accept paying 4% OA. That's clearly not gonna work. Then the data came out that showed that it was increasing their basket size. That was a light bulb moment. It was like, okay, wow, if it actually works for merchants, and I don't think you can predict that. That's the sort of thing that you have to get from data. You shouldn't wander around trying to make predictions like that. But once you see it, you should recognize that how important that is. And that was really the key to their success. It was being able to demonstrate value to merchants. So merchants were able to, and merchants have access to their own data. They always had access to how much they were selling, who was using what to pay, and whether adding Afterpay increased the value of basket sizes, increased total revenues or not. Similarly, Square was very focused on merchants. So their original thing was that Square credit card reader. And now they've moved into the consumer, whereas obviously Afterpay was also widely loved by consumers. So both of them had the two pieces, the merchant and the consumer, and the combination is powerful. You know, this is really something PayPal should have done many, many years ago, and I'm sure if Elon Musk and Peter Thiel were still running the show, it would have happened, you know, 5, maybe even 10 years ago, but it didn't, which is a huge opportunity for these two. Now, what we sold our Afterpay shares, but we owned about 6% in Square, which is one of our largest positions. So we sold after the acquisition announcement. We're going to maintain 6-7% in Square, the combined Square Afterpay company, which we think is about right. I might wrap things up there. I hope that was interesting. I'll do a webinar in the next week or so. So if you have any questions, please let me know. I actually recorded this once or twice, or once before, and the audio didn't work. So I bought a new microphone, and if you have any feedback on that, please let me know. If you'd like to know more about us, you can go to www.frazerscapitalpartners.com. And I hope you found that interesting. Thanks so much for listening.